Blog Talk Radio.
I stroll through the picture, what I've left behind. You want again. I'm locked up in memories, they all intertwine. The memories in my mind. I know tomorrow, 'cause that dawn will come. You will never know just what you have done.
Good evening, everybody. This is Annie Margis, and I'm here on SCAN Radio Show 2997. SCAN stands for Stop Child Abuse Now, and it's a production of NASCA, the National Association of Adult Survivors of Child Abuse. NASCA is a nonprofit 501c3. And I'm going to read the mission statement of NASCA. We have a single purpose at NASCA: to address issues related to childhood abuse and trauma, including sexual assault, violent or physical abuse, emotional traumas, and neglect. And we do so with only two goals. One, educating the public, especially as related to helping society get over its taboo of discussing childhood sexual abuse, presenting facts showing child abuse to be a pandemic worldwide problem that affects everyone. And two, offering hope and healing through numerous paths, providing many services to adult survivors of child abuse and information for anyone interested in the many issues involving prevention, intervention, and recovery. And this is SCAN Radio Show, and tonight our special guest host will be Bill Murray from Los Angeles, our founder. Bill's recovery is 12-step based and spans over 3.5 decades. Sexually abused by numerous clerics, all men, between the ages of 11 and midway through high school, a minor seminary, he was also the victim of prepubescent pornography and even a 2-week kidnapping. Bill was graced to have found Alcoholics Anonymous when he was 30 years old. The program not only helped him get clean and sober, but also gave him a place to give up his secrets and the tools by which he's recovered. He firmly believes one can use the 12-step process to heal from child abuse trauma and to find a way to a comfortable life. On these episodes, we welcome various co-hosts, survivor professionals who will assist in fielding questions and lead a variety of topics suggested by our call-in participants. Their trauma-informed perspectives as survivor professionals will help them guide discussions on the issues of child abuse, trauma, and healthy human sexuality that spring from questions and topics brought to us by our listeners. Everyone's invited to engage on tonight's show. Please visit the NASCA website, and that is naasca.org. And with that, I would like to introduce Bill Murray. Are you there, Bill?
I am here. Thank you very much, Annie. You did a great job with that introduction.
Thank you. Thank you, Bill. And also on the line with us tonight is Dr. Nancy.
Yes. Hi, Nancy.
You want to say hi?
Hi, Annie. Hi, Bill. Annie, you did a great job tonight. Thank you for the great introduction. I agree. And hi, Bill.
Oh, thank you.
Can't wait to hear your story. Oh. Yes.
Hello, ladies. Well, I haven't yet decided what kind of show I want to do. I can do a lot of different kinds of shows, of course. I can do part of my story. I can do, you know, I can talk about how NASCA developed. I can talk about, you know, all kinds of issues of child abuse and trauma, but not even relating to NASCA or me, and so forth. There's a lot of bases that could be covered tonight, and we only have the one show. So I'll leave it up to you guys what you want to hear, but I'm happy to talk about any topic at all.
I don't have a topic to offer. Do you, Dr. Nancy?
Yeah, I think it's definitely, you know, just from looking at the bio, I know that we have a lot. This is just a little bit of what we can cover, but definitely, you know, we're talking about the road to recovery. And I think that it's important for us to, for those that are first-time listeners, they've never heard your story, maybe you can share some of what led you to go into addiction, maybe starting with a little bit about your earlier years and some of the abuse that you encountered, some of the triggers, and then we can go into the recovery of it. I mean, that would be great.
Sure. You know, it was funny. I was watching a television show tonight, or today or yesterday, whenever it was, and it was about serial killers. And it was about how they developed the theme of how to predict a serial killer. And, of course, there are three major predictors that they found out. This is in the early 70s when they first realized that they could study this and then offer what they learned to future FBI agents. And the three were bedwetting, fire starting, and killing of animals. The other thing they discovered was that many sexual sadists who were turned into serial killers had very bad relationships with their mother. They had a love-hate relationship with their mother, actually. Mm-hmm. They definitely loved their mother, but they hated that she was their mother. And I identified with that.
Yeah.
Wow. Maybe it's a predictor for me. I don't know. My mother's passed already, so she's safe. But the thing is that an awful lot of us have struggled with the parents we grew up with, you know, and we look at our parents and we go, how could I be a part of that? Well, I had a reason. Because I was adopted, I believed that my genealogy was completely different than my mom and dad's, because I was not related to them. And until just a couple of years ago, I had no idea who my birth mother was. So I just chalked it up to the fact that I was, you know, the fact that I wanted to be some kind of creative person or artist or whatever, and my father was a businessman, and my mother was a librarian. So they thought that the arts were only for, you know, for play. they were fun to do, but not to take seriously, not for a career, you know. So that was an example. That's an example of one of the things that I was disappointed in, because I never got support for the arts, and I had very deep, you know, senses about the arts. I was extremely talented in some areas and not trained enough to take advantage of it in others. But it was obvious that I had, you know, a penchant for creative things. So anyway, that's an example. My mother, you know. No, it's okay for a hobby, but not for a, you know.
What area of art, Mr. Bill, what area of art were you into?
Actually, a lot of things, but the one that I was able to express without being given any tools or anything was voice, singing. Mm-hmm. I was extremely interested in music, and, of course, as a child, you're born with a voice or not. And I was a voice and an ear. And so I was able to practice. I got into every kind of singing you could get into, and starting in grade school all the way through, and then in high school, and then later in college, and then after that, my 20s and 30s, I played music, and I wasn't really a good musician because I didn't pick up the instruments until I was about 20, but I had the voice all along. So really, that's my instrument. And I also had an interest in art of different kinds. I dabbled around with painting and things like that. But mainly, it's expressed itself in music, and then of course in film, because that's where I ended up having a career, and that was not necessarily acceptable, but eventually. My parents understood it could be a career, and it was. So I did film and TV, in my second time at college, and then that became my career. Yeah.
So can I ask you a question? For your father, I know you said your father was a businessman. So how did that make you feel? Like how did it make you feel, the fact that he was a businessman and you were an artist? And maybe at some point he wasn't really too fun or too supportive of that artistry. How did you feel about that? Did you feel you disappointed him?
I just said to myself, it's too bad, but he's a little older, a little older than a normal dad would be.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause I think he adopted me when he was 37 or 38, which is a little on the older side. And so, as I grew up, he wasn't capable of, tossing the football and stuff like that as much. And he also traveled a lot. His business was, as a salesman, he went all over the world, and he had offices, in different countries and so forth. And, he was gone a lot, about a third of the time.
Mm-hmm.
That bothered me a little. But, that's the way it is. And, I had friends whose fathers were in the military, because we lived in a military area, and their fathers were gone, like 6 months at a time, 8 months, 9 months at a time, or a year at a time. And they were constantly pulling their roots up and going to some other, the other side of the country or another country. So I kind of understood that was part of what happened with certain careers. But I won't lie to you. I wish that he had been more interested in assisting me with some of the sports and stuff like that. But he did in other ways. Fun, when he used to build small pieces of furniture, bookcases, things like that. And he also did a lot of painting in and out of the house, and he also did a lot of wallpapering. So I was his little helper, and I learned all those skills before I went to high school. Certainly I had them all because I had done them many times. So, that's the kind of thing that we shared. The time that we shared was really his time off, but I worked with him. And that was fulfilling to a certain extent. I always appreciated my dad, that he was a very hard worker. I also felt he wasn't as bright as I'm saying this, and I don't mean to denigrate him, but I'm pretty bright, and he wasn't as bright. I could tell, I absolutely knew he loved me, So, yeah.
When did you find out you were adopted?
They always told me that. I came home from the hospital, or the adoption agency, or whatever it was, Catholic Charities, and, they said, "Oh, we're so glad we adopted you." They told me from the very beginning. And I always knew that. And that was like the first thing I ever heard, first thing I ever learned about myself before I even knew what it meant. So, but I was 3 months old. So there's no sense of whatever came before in my memory, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And now I know more of the story. But back then I didn't know anything, and they didn't know anything. So it was just... it was an accepted mystery. They did a lot of special things for my sister and I. She was also adopted a year and a half later. and from a different family and so forth. But we were both like blonde hair, blue-eyed, and so were my parents. Well, my father was black hair, blue-eyed, but we were blue-eyed family. And, you know, they tried to match you with the same kind of people you were back then. And this, by the way, is I was born in 1953, so I'm an old guy. And at 69, I'm now learning what my birth family was like, what my birth mother was like. I'm still not seeing a picture of her, but I'm working on it with a couple of people who are helping me with ancestry and so forth. Because, you know, I kind of tripped into it. I wasn't necessarily looking very hard for her or anything, because it just, I accepted that I was adopted. Oh, well, you know, it was fine. But now I, since my parents are both gone, especially, it's brought up an interest in finding out what my sort of genetic past was. And it's fascinating to do that.
I want to ask a little more about that, but Miss Sandy, do you have any questions? Like, as we're talking about this, does anything particular come to mind?
Well, I've been taking some notes, and I'm so interested about that the adoption agency would match people by their eye color. That just blew me away.
Well,
there ought to be
days,
like a psychiatric test or something. I don't know.
In those days, there were a certain number of children, but not as many as there are today. You know, today, if you go to an adoption agency and you qualify, they'll give you 5 kids if you want them. You know, there's a big need, and it'll be a completely mixed family. And by the way, I have aunts and uncles and cousins who did do that. But in my case, I was born in New York City, and you could only have 2 kids in New York City. And so when my time came around, they got me first and my sister later. But they were both through Catholic Charities, which means that our parents were, you know, undoubtedly a Catholic as well. And they, you know, they gave us up for adoption to the nuns at Catholic Charities or whatever it was. And, you know, so that's an example of how they matched people. So if you were, you know, if you were ethnically different than your parent, than potential parents, you probably wouldn't have been put together with them. Nowadays, they certainly will, but not then. So, you know, we could only have 2, as I said. So our family was small in comparison to all my other cousins. I had a big family, 63 cousins, I think.
And this is from your adopted side? Is this from your adopted side?
No, my father's side. My father's side was a big family. And my mother's side had only 3 cousins, one sister who had 3 cousins. So all my cousins are from my father's side of the family. And, you know, that was fascinating to me. I loved being a Murray, you know. When we ever got to be in the same town as they, most of them lived in, it was wonderful because everybody knew the Murrays, everybody. And Rockville Center, Long Island, was where they were from. So, you know, I cherished that. I wished I was closer to it, frankly. I wish that we lived in Rockville Center because I would have loved to have had more relatives around all the time, but I didn't. So, yeah.
So can I ask you a question? So, okay, so you're biologically a Murray?
I had a parent, I don't know who my father was. He might have been a drifter or something, or a one-night stand. Mm-hmm. But my mother, I do know now. I found her in the registry for, you know, 23andMe or whatever. She was French-Canadian. So my ancestors came from Europe via France and England, and certain of them went to French Canada, which is Quebec, of course, and there were my immediate family was only my mother. There's no father, and I think I have a brother who's also was put up for adoption in the following year, and then I have a couple of cousins that I don't know any of these people, but I got to. I got to meet a person that did know some of them, mm-hmm. who came from the same town, who's also on Ancestry, and she's been helping me just recently to put some of the leads together and so forth. So I found out my mother was an artist too. That's where I got the artistic stuff. Her expression of her art was in dance, maybe voice too, but acting and dance. And specifically, she became a professional can-can dancer in France. And she went back to France and celebrated can-can dancing with the army to entertain troops and stuff like that. So I'm really hoping that I could someday find like a pinup picture of her, because she also did some of that. And because I know they exist. And she was apparently a very beautiful gal who, had a desire to get into the arts too. And she did get into the arts, but not for her whole life, but for her early life, absolutely. So my father, we don't know who he was. My grandfather was a granite cutter, a stone cutter, and he worked in the quarries in Vermont. But he had moved to Vermont after the quarries he was working with in Quebec didn't have any more work or something, and so he went to the United States and found work in Vermont. And as a result, my mother and her two sisters, my grandfather and his wife, all lived in either lower Vermont or northern Massachusetts, around that border. They lived there until a long time, but that's where they ended up after coming from French Canada.
So there's 23 in you. You just, how did you even bump into this? What made you go into this DNA 23 in you, or whatever it's called? I'm not sure exactly if that's the name. That's the name
it's
of it?
It's called 23andMe, it's a genealogy tool where you send them your DNA by spitting in a little tube, and they analyze the spittle.
Wow.
And they can tell you all kinds of things about you that, you would never know any other way, because it's DNA related, And it's fascinating to me. That just on that level, it's fascinating to me. They have millions of people who are doing it. It's more and more popular all the time. And every time somebody puts their DNA in the database, there's another chance that someone will be related to you. Right?
Wow.
So the relations are often like fifth cousin or something. That's too far away to make any sense. But then I had a couple that were third cousins, and I had a couple that were second cousins. That's much easier to find. And I found one second cousin who sure enough was my mother's nephew. He did not want to talk. He talked to me friendly-like in the first time or two I talked to him. And then for some reason he didn't want to talk anymore. And I think it was, I don't know, he discovered something about my birth or his sister or his aunt or something. And so he stopped talking to me. But that's how I got the, that's how I got the beginning of what's going on now. And now I'm being helped by a couple of people, but the one that's newest to me really knew them well, and even sent me a kind of a foggy picture of my grandfather, and she's still looking for for his daughter, my mom, but we haven't found that yet.
Wow.
Yeah.
That is so cool. I mean, there are so many different ways, and for anyone who's listening who is adopted and ever thought about, got to a place where they were like, well, I'm never going to find anyone. It's just nobody knows anything. Hey, DNA can track down family members. And if that's something that's in your heart and it's something you thought about, don't give up hope. You can still try it that way. That's something that I've actually heard a few people tell me something similar. So, I wanted to go back to what you were talking about as far as serial killers,
yeah.
The bedwetting, the fire starter, the animal killers, because I know I researched that one time, and I actually know people that did some of those things, right? And
right.
They're not, you know, they're not serial killers. And then I know people, you know, who are serial killers, and they may just cross out one or two of these things, but this is something that they do have in common, that fire starter, animal killers. Like, when you start to notice kids doing things like that, it's important to reach out for help, and I'm so glad you brought those things up. Did you do any of these things or all three of these things, or did you do any of these things, like the bedwetting at a later age,
no.
Fire starting?
No,
or, yeah.
I didn't do any of them, really. I mean, I did some of the really kind of innocent stuff, like I had a bow and arrow, and I used to try and get a bird with my bow and arrow, but it wasn't because I was
mm-hmm.
vicious about it.
Yeah.
I never
some people do the hunting.
Down,
so,
and I never,
yeah.
Huh? Yeah.
No, I said some people go right. hunting. I mean, they don't feel
yeah,
like
exactly.
it's, you know, right.
So my relative of mine got me a bow and arrow, so and a target, and I got tired of shooting only at the target, so I went in the woods and tried to shoot a couple of birds. But that was just having fun. I wasn't vicious or anything. Didn't do any fire starting, and I didn't do any bedwetting.
And what
now,
about the love
course.
Hate?
That's because of
what?
69.
You do the bedwetting now? I'm done, Joe. Cut it out. What about the love-hate relationship with the mother? You heard that, Miss Annie?
Yes.
You heard him say so he's still doing the bedwetting.
So,
what about the love-hate relationship with the mother?
What about the relationship with the mother?
Yeah, did you have a love-hate
well,
relationship
that's where I found this,
at some point?
This, yeah.
Growing up?
That was where I found some relationship to the serial killer that they originally studied, Kemper, Ed Kemper. He was
mm-hmm.
a Floridian, I mean a Californian, who killed a bunch of people in the Santa Cruz area in the early 70s. And he was caught, and he was 6'9" tall, and he was
wow.
He was 300 pounds. He was a giant man. But other than the fact that he was a serial killer, he was kind of gentle, you know, and he didn't have anything against you. You had no problem. You had no worry. And the only people that he killed his grandfather, and everybody else was female. And a lot of them were young females that were hitchhiking and he picked up and killed. He would have sex with their body parts and stuff like that. He was pretty sick. Now, I've never had any
mm-hmm.
of that. But
right.
one of the things that he did do was they think that his predilection for anger, against women, developed because of his relationship with his mother, where he loved his mother. They know that. They decided that that was not the problem. But he also hated her, and she was very hard
right.
on him. And she would I called it interrogating. I remember getting interrogated by my mom, you know, and she.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted her to shut up, and. He
mm-hmm.
he related to this for years. He had this problem. His father, I think, had left or something. So he was kind of staying with his mom and later with his grandparents. First thing he did was he killed his grandparents in their home.
Mm-hmm.
And then he came, and he didn't get caught. He never got caught. Eventually he surrendered to the police.
Wow.
In Santa Cruz when he was... He was kind of tired of it, and he had killed 9 or 10 people, and got away with all of them. But they knew who he was because he had a criminal past, but not a murderous past. And the marker in that case is an intense hatred for the woman you love, for the mother you love, like that. And I could see a little bit of that.
Yeah.
I couldn't believe how my mother tried to treat us. And I was able, it was really in recovery. that I was able to separate myself from my mother, and I could not get my sister to understand how to do that. And as a result, she suffered terribly for the rest of her life, and she died when she was 50 years old. My mother kind of killed her from the stress.
Oh, your sister passed away.
Yeah, she passed away at 50, and I then started to have to take care of my mother, who by then was, you know, an older woman. And that's why I started going to Florida, because my mom lived in Florida by then. She lived in a, you know, senior place. And I spent at least a third, probably a half of the time in Florida, so that my mother had a relative around. And so that's an example. I really did not appreciate how she treated us, but on the other hand, I loved her enough to dedicate a great deal of my life to, you know, trying to make her have a good life, you know. But I would not let her get over on me the way she used to get over on my sister, because I had learned the concept of setting boundaries and of saying no. And Jane couldn't. Jane couldn't say no to my mother, and it drove her crazy. Jane had four children and a demanding husband, and she drove these kids all over, you know, the county, and they all went to different places. They all went to different schools. They all had different soccer teams. They had, you know, they all had different things. And my sister was constantly in her minivan, picking up and dropping people off. And then she was, you know, doing all the yard work and all that stuff too. So, I understood that my mother, when she got to Florida, had certain, I'll call them demands, they were demands, that Jane and I pay attention to certain things as if we had to do them. And, of course, I knew we didn't have to do them. If we did them, okay. But if there was some reason we couldn't do them on that day or whatever, I could say no. Jane couldn't. So my mother was very controlling in that sense, and it drove me crazy, and it drove my sister to death. Yeah. So.
Miss Annie?
Yes.
Do you have any any questions you want to ask? Did you want to say anything? Anything in regards to that?
No, I think I'm good. I'll continue listening. Thank you.
Okay. Yes, ma'am. Okay, so Mr. Bill, as far as your mom being controlling, because you know a lot of people can relate to that.
Exactly. It doesn't.
Let me
it's
ask
not
you
a predictor. It doesn't mean that you're absolutely going to become a certain kind of person, nor does
right.
it be predictors
of
fire service. Setting. Huh?
Oh yeah. No, I'm glad you shared that information, because a lot of one time I was really researching this, and people need to hear this, because some people have small children who are doing some of
right.
the things you said. So I'm glad you even
That's
brought
right.
that up. That was very important to bring up.
That's right.
What I wanted
That's
to
right.
What I wanted to ask you, as far as, you know, with your mom, when you started going through your abuse, and I know you're going to get into that, what were you able to tell your parents? Were they able, you know, because normally, and the reason why I let you tell us all that, because a lot of times when it comes to your mother, you know, the mothers and the parents, they're supposed to protect you. Okay, they're supposed to protect you. That's what we believe. That's what we believe, and that's what we know, that that's how it should be, right? But
right.
when did you get to this place of abuse, and how did your parents, because now these were your parents, whether they were adopted or not, they were the people who were
right.
your parents. How did
oh, absolutely.
They, what did they do to protect you?
They did not know.
When
did
the abuse start?
Them.
Did you tell them? You didn't tell them?
I did not tell them.
Okay.
They sent me to a summer camp when I was, I think it was 11 years old, and I was sent there for a month, and it was one of these camps where you didn't go home for the month, and, you know, your parents came back after a month and picked you up and took you back home, and then school started.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the month that I was there, I was approached by the guy that was in charge of the pool and the water sports and the cameras, the photography.
Mm-hmm.
And he became my first molester, and he was a brother, a Christian brother, Catholic brother, and this camp was run by Catholic brothers, And so, you know, I was supposed to be able to be protected by anyone who was a cleric, a priest or a brother. You know, there's nothing in our world that was of a higher caliber than a brother or a priest. You know, we looked up to them all. We were taught like that, just like some kids are taught, you know, you always look up to a cop. Well, we were very religious, very Catholic. So I was scared to death that I didn't know what it was, first of all, because no one had ever talked to me about it. And a lot of it happened in the dark room, where, you know, you can close the door and turn the red light on outside and nobody will come in.
Where you develop film?
Was I what?
The dark room is where you develop film you're talking about?
Yeah, and pictures.
Yeah.
Right. You develop pictures, right. And that's one of the skills that I did take up because of him. And it was directly related to the fact that I went into film and TV later. But I had my own cameras and dark rooms and stuff through high school because, you know, of my experience in grade school with him. And he had wonderful equipment. He had Nikon cameras and, you know, terrific, well-stocked dark rooms. And he loaded his own film. He taught me a lot. Anyway, this relationship lasted 3 years. And the second year I went back for another month, and the third year I went back for another month. And the third year, he invited my parents to allow me to go to an Expo 67. Expo 67 was kind of a world fair that was held in Montreal.
Mm-hmm.
And he said he was going to be able to get to Expo 67 between the end of camp and when school started in a few weeks, because he was a teacher in the regular year. Would they like it if Bill came along? He's going to go anyway. Oh, yes, we'd love that, brother. So they had no idea what they were turning, you know, over to, but that was a horrible 3-4 weeks because it was 2 or 3 weeks. But anyway, the point is that the whole time prior to that, I had not had to do anything to him. I was the object of his photography, which he took a lot of pornography of me, and also he would play with me sexually with his hands and his mouth and stuff. And it was pleasurable, but I was not required to return the favor. And so when the third year came around, I had to be sent up to New York to meet him. And they sent me on a bus from Virginia, got to New York, to the bus station. And he met me there. We went out to his car, got in the car, and for the first time, he unzipped his trousers and pushed my head down into his lap, you know. And I went, what are you doing? You know, I really reacted badly. And that was the sense of what happened for the whole 2 or 3 weeks, because he kept trying to get me to interact either with him or with other pedophiles and their young people. So it was a couple times, 3 or 4 times maybe, that there was an older man and a young boy who he introduced me to, I think ostensibly to have me interact with the other man so they could, like, trade partners for a little while. I don't know. But I refused.
Yeah.
And so he was getting more and more angry. And we did all kinds of weird things during this time.
Yeah.
Mark, he played with me under the boardwalk at Coney Island. You know, he had somebody must have given him a little apartment, I think it was in Queens maybe, where he kept almost nothing, a mattress on the floor and a box of silly clothing that became some of what he had me dress up in every now and then to take more pictures. And there was a penthouse where there was an older man and a younger boy, you know, and none of these places worked to entice me to do anything myself. And I was terrified. I didn't know how to get out of there because there wasn't any 911 services back then, you know. And I suppose I knew my parents' number. I guess I did because I was you know, late grade school. But for whatever reason, I felt trapped in it, and I just wanted to hold on until I could get away. And when I did get away and went home, I still didn't tell my parents. And I went off to college, to high school at a minor seminary as a freshman in that seminary, freshman in high school. And I eventually told the story to a priest who was there who was very interested in whether or not I had had any homosexual experiences. And I denied it a couple of times, but then finally I decided, okay, I'll tell him. And I did. And it took hours for me to tell him the whole story that I just told you in a lot more detail. But he called it a confession, which is a kind of a sacred thing. It's a sacrament in Catholicism, where the priest represents Christ, the penitent represents, you know, man, but is able to relate to the priest the sins and transgression and so forth that they've done since their last confession. And then the priest, as Christ, offers absolution. And, you know, it's how you cleanse your soul. And you have to do this periodically because we all know we sin every day, you know. So I thought, though, when this was done, wow, I've gotten some relief. Thank God, you know. And unfortunately, the guy turned out to be a pedophile himself.
Oh my God!
You can't pick him out. Then another priest, then another brother, then an upperclassman. He must have been telling people, or they must have been sharing, you know, the new guy in town, me, the information about me, because I kept trying to run away from these people. One of them, one of the worst, was my Latin teacher, because I was required to take 2 years of Latin, and I bailed on my first year of Latin. I did terribly. And I had to go to summer school to earn, you know, a C in Latin or something so I could come back. But this guy, you know, that was the thing. He had me over the barrel because you were required to take Latin. And he was the only Latin teacher. So he would, like, lean over my shoulder and put his hands down in my lap and pretend to be reading my book, you know, my homework and stuff like that. He was a problem for me for a couple of years. And so around junior high, I mean, a junior as a high school student, I think I had a growth spurt. And when I came back for junior year, I wasn't going to let myself get messed with. And so I was tougher. You know, I think I had some pimples and stuff, but maybe it wasn't as attractive. But I was definitely bigger. And for some reason, that kind of protected me a little bit because I wasn't a kid anymore, you know. And I went off to college. No way I was going to continue to college at St. Vincent's, the place I'm talking about, because although I would have been automatically allowed into the college there, you know, I wanted to get away again. So this time I got away to the University of Toronto, and my first time at college was at U of T, and I didn't get a degree, but I stayed there like 2.5 years, I guess, and that's where I learned how to drink. I never had drank, because, you know. But
can we go into something before we go into the drinking? Sorry, because that's important. I don't mean to cut you off, Mr. Bell. I apologize for that, because I do want you to go into the drinking part, but. Miss Annie, did you have any questions about this priest or anything like that? Because I do have a couple of questions, but I wanted to know, well, did you have any questions or concerns or comments?
I have several comments, I think. Mm. I understand Bill's feeling that the priests were, like, so important and godlike and holy and talking directly to Jesus and stuff like that. That's how it was in my family. We just, I mean, the priest could do no wrong. Oh, my goodness, you just worship. There was one in my family. One of my uncles was a priest. And it was weird because everybody just worshiped him. What else did I want to say? That being older protected you. I think that protected me as well. I think by the time I was in sixth grade, the abuse had stopped, sexual abuse by my father. And, mm-hmm. yeah, because I was no longer the kid-looking person.
Mm-hmm.
That's mm-hmm. all. Thank you.
Yeah, that was good. It's so true. Wow. Go ahead.
It's too, Annie, because, mm-hmm. you know, I just wasn't the,
wow.
you know, when I first was approached by the original brother, I didn't have a hair on my body, you know. I didn't have a thought in my mind about anything sexual. In fact, I'd never even heard the word sex before, because we didn't talk about stuff like that at home. So I was really mm-hmm. washed about all of this. And that summer, I mean that school year, I started to hear stuff about sex. Of course, I was hearing it on the playground from other kids, and it was horrible information.
Mm-hmm. mm-hmm.
But I heard that when you have sex with the same sex, that you're a faggot, that you're gay, that you're, you know, that kind of language. And I didn't mm-hmm. want to be called that, you know. And I was never attracted to men, ever. But I was involved with them as their object, really. And I was trying to get away from them all the time, but it's, if you don't have the power for an automobile to drive away or something, you're stuck there in your life. And I'll tell you, one thing was true. I was not capable of talking to my parents. And I was asked that before.
Mm-hmm.
But we did not have the relationship that was close enough for me to risk when it happened. And when I did tell them, I can tell that story too, but it happens in my mid-20s,
mm-hmm.
you know. Predictably, they kind of overreacted. But anyway, yeah.
Let me ask you something, because
yep.
you said a lot of, I don't want to say, well, I'm going to say good stuff, even though it's not good stuff, but you said a lot of stuff that was really important, because a lot of parents, and the reason why I'm bringing this up is because there's a lot of people that are listening who send their kids away for summer camp, you know,
right.
and
right.
there are signs that they may not catch, or there's conversations. What type of conversations would have helped you growing up, maybe if your parents would have had with you? And this is for, like, parents that are sending their kids, the importance of being transparent and having these conversations with your children. What would you say, like, that, because you said they didn't talk about sex, we didn't talk about sex, you said that a couple of times. You know, so you weren't really educated in that area. You were learning. Somebody else was teaching you. The kids were teaching you. These men were teaching you. What would you say to the parents that maybe that they could open up a conversation with their children?
Well, this is an area of prevention. We always talk about the issues of
yeah.
child abuse and its recovery coming in three pieces: prevention, intervention, mm-hmm. and recovery. And prevention and intervention are for the youngsters and for the parents. Recovery is for us when we're an adult and we've already been traumatized, and how do we get out of that?
Yeah.
How do we calm our lives down? But prevention is the first thing that should happen, I believe. And that has to do with informing your child from as early as possible as simple things, and then get more and more complicated as they grow up, and more age appropriate to the age that there are. But you start with, you know, not talking about the names of their body parts, you know, and really
mm-hmm.
they start talking the time you do it. So you talk about mm-hmm. having breasts, not titties, you know, and
mm-hmm.
you talk about
mm-hmm.
having a penis, not a willy, you know,
mm-hmm.
and so forth. So, and not a cookie,
mm-hmm.
if you're a girl, but a vagina, you know. and as you educate them in the right kind of language, it's easier then to get to the next phase, which you want to learn. And that, you know, there are people in the world that will take advantage of young kids and even adults, but as far as they're concerned, young kids. And it might be difficult for them to, you know, to keep them at bay unless they thought about it ahead of time. So you think about
mm-hmm.
things ahead of time, like who would I go to? And, you know, you
mm-hmm.
because if you are touched or if you are approached, you want to go to an adult that you trust and tell them what had happened, and let the adults help you out of it. But
Right.
You know, when you teach a kid that, you know, that's not the first discussion you should have. You should have other discussions, and and talk about how people aren't allowed to touch you. Mom and dad are like change diapers and stuff, but or get a bath or something, but nobody else. And you know, I don't like that description of protect the bathing suit area, because there are other areas that need protection, and I would include, for example, oral protection, and that's nothing to do with the bathing suit, and also manual protection. So you have to protect yourself from any kind of touching from a person that feels bad to you, or you know already, because we're talking about it, it would be inappropriate. Okay, and then if you tell somebody and they don't help, you tell somebody else, and then you tell somebody else, and you keep telling until you find the person who's going to really hear what you're saying and give you help, and that's prevention, you know. In essence,
I agree.
And you want to trust, you try to pick ahead of time who you can relate this stuff to. It might not be mom and dad, although it might be, especially if it's a mom who's explaining this to their child. She won't be shocked if the child comes to her and says, you know, remember when you said that about my, I could come and talk to you? Yes. Oh, I want to talk to you about what happened yesterday, you know, like that.
Or it might be a parent doing the abusing, so the kids need to find someone safe. Right.
Well, exactly. That's why I said it could be an adult, a parent, but it could also be, you know, somebody like the school's counselor, you know, or something, or your teacher, or it could be a relative. Yes. Anyway, that's all prevention stuff. Yeah.
Right. Miss Annie said something that I was able to relate to. And Mr. Bill, you said the same thing. You know, when you got older, you felt stronger. You felt like you can protect yourself, that person couldn't hurt you. And I remember when I went through my abuse from my abuser, when I got older, I went through a rebellious stage. And when I was in front of my abuser, I was like, one time I like lit up a cigarette. I don't even smoke cigarettes, but I just wanted him to see that I was strong and I was grown and you couldn't hurt me no more. And I was like being so extra and so extra strong or extra rude because I wanted that person to know that they didn't have that control to hurt me anymore. And it was because I was bigger, right? My abuse happened when I was 5 years old. So when I was 13, 12, probably like 11 or something, I think, 12, that's when I was bigger and I was able to show my strength and I was able to, you know, be rude and kind of be strong so that this person couldn't hurt me anymore. That was my way to show that you will not hurt me anymore. But a lot of us, you know, we believe in, like you said, you know, you have this respect for authority, whether it's a police officer or whether it's a priest, you know, you have this respect for them. But what did that do to you, Bill, finding out that the same person that you looked up to, who was a priest, became one of the pedophiles? What did that do to you for the view of authority?
Well, it was a notion that I came to while I was in recovery, early recovery, but recovery. It took until I was, you know, trying to fix myself, trying to heal, to come up with the concept that, you know, some priests were bad, but not all priests. And maybe even most priests were not bad, but there were some that were really bad. And unfortunately, I knew some of them. Same thing would be true of, of law enforcement and so forth. So I had to wait, though, to get that kind of concept when I was already in recovery and committed to being in recovery. Otherwise, it wouldn't happen. I would have walked around with that same, you know, horrible feeling about people in authority, basically.
Right. Miss Annie?
What?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Miss Annie, did you ever have, did you ever have any experiences with a priest? I know you said that you also believe like a priest could do no wrong, or a person in authority, whether it was a law enforcement or a counselor, somebody you trusted on a high level, that you had that. And what did that do to you? Like,
Well, yeah, because it was my father, and I was supposed to give my father all of my obedience and all of my honor and be, you know, in that Irish Catholic culture that I came from, the father was like God, and then the priest came in. And so being abused by my father, it was like, it was a real, I mean, I lost my mind. I became delusional because of that.
Right.
So it was, it affected me badly.
Yes. I could relate. Yeah, that was difficult. Mr. Bill, so when did you reach out for help?
We know what we're talking about when we say the kind of the trust that we were asked to give was deep. I mean, it was since we were born.
Yeah.
You know, we had this drilled into us. Catholic
respect.
Anyway.
Yeah.
So,
no, I understand. I went to Catholic school.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. But she understood as soon as I said it, and I'm not. I wouldn't be surprised if some of our listeners did too.
Yeah, I understand. I used to go to the priest, and I used to. I did my first communion, and I used to, you know, go in and confess my sins, and we used to do that. So I understand, you know, once you're like, you know, you respect the religion, you respect God, and you honor God, and then you're learning about the religion, and you're trying to do the best that you can, and it's all about honor and respect, right? So when did you reach out for help, or when did you tell? Did you ever tell anyone what you were dealing with?
No, I never told anyone until one day I was I was in college, but I was home for some reason, and my parents were there, and I said to my mother, I poured myself a giant, you know, vodka and a little bit of orange juice. I made like a screwdriver, you know, and I drank it and. We were having a conversation about this place I went to school, and I said, "Oh, what do they know? They're all gay." My mother said, "What?" You know, and it kind of had slipped out. So I thought to myself, "I better tell her about it. Better tell them about it." My mom and dad, but what I'm going to tell them about will help. So I agreed that they would make an appointment with. Psychiatrist, and my apartment was in New York City, and their home was in Connecticut. So I came up from Brooklyn, they went down from Connecticut, and we met at an office of somebody in Manhattan, and somebody neutral that none of us knew, my girlfriend at the time, who I later married, was with me, and you know, I told the story. And I was worried because my father, I thought, was going to have a heart attack. And, you know, he almost did. I wanted to be in the presence of some medical person or whatever, you know, as I told the story for the first time.
Right.
And it was scary.
Right.
He doubled over. He nearly fell out of the chair, you know. And my mother was steaming, you know. And her comment was, how could the priest have done this to me? Meaning her. She didn't do it to her. They did it to me. But she related to being offended.
Betrayed.
They betrayed her and my dad. Right. So I did go back to this psychiatrist about maybe four or five times. But they were, you know, significant sessions. I basically told them, everyone in the room, that, you know, as much as I could, and they asked all their questions and stuff like this, and, you know, I thought, okay, well, I told them, now they knew. Now they knew from that point on, obviously. But I was already drinking heavily, doing drugs, you know, living with a girl that I wasn't, you're not supposed to live with girls until you marry them, but that didn't matter to me. I was going to do what I was going to do.
Right.
So that's when to answer your question in a roundabout way, I was probably 27, something like that, when I told him. Yeah.
So then, so the girlfriend at that time is the person you said you married that person?
Eventually, yeah.
Eventually? Okay. So now, why were you drinking and doing drugs?
Well, because I hated myself. I hated who I was, myself, what was going on in me. I felt I got a relief through alcohol and later drugs, first alcohol, and then later drugs. And so I was able to drive. I didn't know anything about addictions or anything like that. But eventually, I had to admit that the alcohol had control of me, not me with the alcohol. I sobered up when I was 30, I guess. So I drank basically for about 12 years, from high school till 30. And I did a lot of drugs along the way. And you know, my way of doing these things was like, give me a bunch, you know. How are those pills you got? Oh, they're great. You want one? Yeah, give me three. Mm-hmm. You know, I'd throw them down my throat. And that's taking drugs alcoholically, basically. I was lucky, though, when I was 30, I fell in with a group in Austin, California, that became my home group. And it was very, very, very hard.
Hold on one second, Bill. Sorry, hold on one second. Miss Annie, could you hear him good?
I could not hear him very well, no.
The phone's breaking up completely, Mr. Bill, and so we're missing a lot of the important parts of your story. So you started drinking, and then alcohol is like doing drugs, and then, Can you go back to that part? Because the phone broke up completely, and we couldn't hear you.
Okay. What I said was I started with alcohol, but I then switched over to whatever drugs I could find. And, of course, the first drugs mostly marijuana and hash at first, but then I took, you know, pills and I took Coke. It was powdered Coke back then. Not a huge amount, but enough. And I loved the stuff. I knew that I was, you know, addicted. I had to get out of it, and it took me until I was 30 years old of doing drugs and alcohol every day. At the end, I was a potaholic, which is what I call it. I was able to stop drinking booze, like beer, but I couldn't stop the drugs, and the drugs I was using was marijuana, and I just smoked like a chimney morning, noon, and night for years, and at the end. But I reasoned that it wasn't as dangerous as alcohol. You know, you could drive when you smoke marijuana. You can't drive when you drink alcohol. So yeah.
So why did you do the drugs? Why did you do the drugs? Yes.
Well, it was there.
Why did you start? Like I'm saying, did somebody introduce you to it?
Well, sure, because everybody was doing drugs. This is the era of the flower child and so forth. It was the end of the era of the flower child. So the 60s had recently been finished. I graduated high school in 71, and I went off to the University of Toronto. And everybody did drugs. Everybody drank, for sure. And drugs is not that uncommon for our group, for my age. Especially lighter drugs, I'll call them lighter. Like marijuana and hash, you know. I didn't do hard drugs for a while. I did do some cocaine and so forth, as I said. But, you know, it was just a natural progression to go from alcohol to drugs back then. And it was just as my father asked me a question like that, too. He said, why do you smoke marijuana? I said, well, look, Dad, if you went to your friend's house and, you know, and they wanted to be nice to you, they would offer you a scotch and water, right? Which is what we got. And I said, well, my friend would offer me a joint. Oh, he says, okay. You know, just pretty much that's what it is, you know.
Right. Yeah. So when did you realize that you were not in control anymore of the drugs or, you know, the alcohol?
I did a test. I was not able to succeed in the test. So I went back to the marijuana smoking, and I was really beating myself up now because I couldn't get I couldn't stop drinking. I couldn't stop the desire to drink. So when I finally decided it was time to go in, I went crawling into an AA meeting I'd been to many times before. Probably 6 months after I met AA is when I sobered up. But I was really, really willing to surrender and to listen and to do whatever I was told, because I couldn't do it. So
did you feel like you were going to die, like, doing the drugs? If you didn't stop? Like, what was the rock bottom?
The rock after I'd stopped drinking. I thought it was going to get better right away when I stopped drinking. No, it's terrible to be an alcoholic who's recently been taken away from his drink and you can't get it. And you you go through withdrawal, basically, of different kinds.
Okay.
Some of it's physical, and some of it's just psychological and mental. The bigger one is the latter. Because the physical, you know, if you're talking about just alcohol, alcohol leaves your body in a few days, the actual alcohol. The craving doesn't. The craving goes on and on and on. And this is why they recommend that you never take the first drink. Because as soon as you take the first drink, you start to soothe the craving, and your body, you know, wants you to go back to drinking again, and many, many people do. So it's not safe to drink once. You save one drink, you know, and that's why we don't drink the first drink.
How did you find out about AA? No, go ahead.
I was doing a film project with a friend of mine, and he told me he was an alcoholic, and I thought to myself, well, as long as he doesn't drink on the job. And he didn't drink on the job.
Right.
It was terrible. He went terrible. But he and I went to dinner afterwards because we had an hour and a half drive home. And we were sitting in the restaurant, and I mentioned to him at the sort of the end of the meal, hey, you didn't even order a beer. And he said, no. And I said, but you told me you were an alcoholic. He said, yeah, but I'm sober now. And that was the first thing I ever heard, first time. It turns out he was sober for like 3 weeks or something, or 3 months. Anyway, he knew all about it, which is part of what happens when you're in recovery at the beginning. And you become a learn-aholic, you know. And he wanted to fix me. So he told me all the things he better learned about it. And just to get him to shut up, I asked, do you think I could go to one of those meetings sometimes? And he did. He took me to a meeting a couple of days later. And, you know, I've been sober ever since.
Wow. From that time that he took you, you've been sober?
Yeah.
Wow.
And clean. Clean and sober means not using drugs and not using alcohol.
Wow. Lathanie, have you ever known anyone, or have you ever done the AA meetings, or like what's your thought about this?
Yes, I have done AA briefly. It wasn't for me, but I was in a program for survivors of incest that was a 12-step program, an anonymous program, and so I do have a lot of experience with that. And I have to say that the 12 steps, I don't know if the 12 steps, I left the program. I'm not sure the 12 steps really did serve me that well. Mostly because I'm an atheist and I had a hard time with higher power, which I'm sure many people do. But I was in the incest program for 10, 12 years, something like that. I don't participate now because I feel like I'm healed.
It worked for 10 or 12 years. That's pretty good.
I know. But, you know, when I go back there now, I listen, and I see people who haven't moved forward at all. And it makes me very sad. And I feel like, well, I have moved forward, and I don't really want to be stuck. You know, I don't want to be stuck with people who are stuck.
Right.
Okay. Hey, and look, as long as it's working for you, that's what it's about. You know, and as long as you're helping with everything that you're doing and you're walking in your chains, that's really what matters. So can I ask you something, Mr. Bill? This AA meetings, not just the AA meetings, the 12-step program, because I know we're getting closer to the end. What is the 12-step program about? Because I actually went and I Googled it, and I thought from my research that it was very faith-based. So Miss Annie just says she's an atheist, and that's her belief, and everybody has to respect everybody's belief. Is the 12-step program faith-based, or is it not faith-based? Can you tell me a little bit about it? For people who don't know what it is,
you could say it was faith based, but you couldn't say it was related to any particular religion or religious belief, because everybody who has the problem with alcoholism is brought in with open arms, and they don't have to believe in the higher power if they don't want to. Now a lot of people don't, like Annie, but they learn over time to see some things as like spiritual actions that are happening, maybe not in them even, but in somebody else. Mm-hmm. And they can relate that to, you know, say the energy of the higher power in the group, you know, even though they can't, they don't believe in it. They can, it's like the educational variety of spirituality. A lot of people have that. But that doesn't mean that you go to any particular church or believe in any particular belief. It simply means that you're not God. That's what it means. There is a God, and it's not me. That's pretty much it.
Right.
It's a principle. So, yes, it's a spiritual program, and you're allowed to have any spirituality you want. You know, you could be a born-again Christian, and you could be a Jew, and you could be Adventist, what's that called? And you could all be sitting in the same group, you know? Doesn't matter.
Was that evangelist? So
yeah,
what
whatever,
are the 12 steps? For someone who's right now listening and they're trying to walk into recovery, and maybe they don't have a religion, they're trying to connect to hope, they're trying to connect to a faith, they're trying to even the faith of change, you know, just for anyone, just a person coming who's at the end of their rope. Can you tell us the 12 steps? Are you able to say one is this, two is that? Because I looked it up and I got to see what the 12 steps are.
I wrote a 12-step based website that deals with sexual abuse of children. It's a link in the description of tonight's
abuse.
Show.
So not what? For alcoholism, the 12 steps for sexual abuse?
Yeah, I only changed two or three words. It's the same 12-step program.
Exactly
the same. Except wherever it says alcohol, I changed it to recovering from trauma, you know, instead of recovering from alcohol. And that's a link in the description of tonight's show where it says 12-step based recovery. And it's the same 12 steps except where it says recovery from child abuse in this group of steps. It says recovery from alcohol or alcoholism in the original one.
Okay.
The 12-step programs were started in 1935, established, and there are millions of people, obviously, who are recovered from this. We're now in our 90th year, or coming up to our 90th year, and, you know, I've been there 39 years. It's amazing. Yeah, because I'm 69 now. Next year I'll be 70, and I'll be 40 years in AA. 4 years in recovery period.
Wow, that's awesome. Congratulations.
Annie's absolutely right. There are all kinds of 12-step programs. They use the same process, but they apply it to the group's, let's say, problem, right? So this was incest, and that's a 12-step program, 12-step Incest Anonymous. There's a Gamblers Anonymous. There's a Cocaine Anonymous. There's an Al-Anon, which is for people who are like spouses of alcoholics. There's Teen Anon, Alcateen, I think it's called. And there are actually about, there are dozens of 12-step programs who simply know, the people who started them know, the power of the regular 12-step program for AA and have molded it slightly so that it fits the problem that they're trying to face. So it's a wonderful thing to see this because I've grown up seeing it come up around me, you know. And so that's where I came from. I decided years later that I would start a 12-step based program. And
you're moving a lot. Who's moving?
I did. Huh?
Oh, somebody's moving a lot. Okay.
I'm sorry, I was moving. Sorry. Excuse me.
No worries. It just it sounds loud. Okay, I'm sorry. I thought it was Mr. Bill. I was trying to get him. Okay, and then you were breaking up a little bit, Bill. That's why I thought it was you. But go ahead. Say that again, please, because that was important what you were saying.
No, there are dozens of 12-step programs.
Yeah.
A person who knew the power of the AA 12-step program, the original one, and simply modified it slightly to address the issue that they had. Like cocaine,
okay.
Or like right. You know, like incest. There's a Sexaholics Anonymous, you know, and there's a Narcotics Anonymous, and all these things, and a Gamblers Anonymous. They're all the same 12 steps with the insert of the word gambler instead of alcoholic, you know, but. It's the same program. So I realized that, you know, I was using it anyway for myself, but it was a private thing. I said, I'll put it on the website. I put up a website and offer it to anybody who finds it. So, you know, but I've been doing it since recovery from, you know, drinking. And the big book even says you can do that. So anyway, I did. And it does work. You know.
Right.
With
so what are the steps?
The steps are that you first thing you find out is that you are not God. Here, we admitted we were powerless over the abuse and trauma of our youth, and that our lives have become unmanageable. So I'm reading the ones that relate to the child abuse stuff. Number two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Number three. Made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. Number four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Number five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Number six, we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Number seven, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. Eight, made a list of persons we had harmed, and became willing to make amends to them all. Nine, made direct amends to such people whenever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for the knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. And the final one is 12, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to other still suffering adult survivors of child abuse and to practice these principles in all our affairs.
Wow. That was awesome. I wanted to say something. If there are any atheists or anyone who has a different faith base or anything like that, God is love. So in the area where we hear the word God, we can substitute it to love. You know, it's really about love, and it's really about self-awareness. And where you talk about prayer or anything like that, it's about meditation and meditation with yourself, connecting with yourself, and loving yourself. Really, that's what it is. You know, God's inside of you. And that's for the people who have that faith base, but love is inside of you. Love lives inside of you. And that's really what it's about at the end of the day, because there are people who have different faiths, but guess what? You don't see love in them. You don't see God in them. And I'll say that for some of us who have had maybe not such great experience with people in church or people in ministry or people in, you know, in the faith community, but at the end of the day, I've met people who are so full of love, and they just didn't grow up that way. They didn't grow up with that type of learning about God or anything like that. So everything that you said really boils down to the power within and the importance of connecting and meditating and learning about self and healing. And everything you said was very powerful and very beautiful. What did you thought about that, Bill?
Right. Thank you. I agree. You know, that's one of the reasons they put in "as we understood him," you know, after the word God, because they realized they were going to have people that, you know, they were atheists, like, you know, we've said tonight.
Right.
And that's fine.
Right.
There's no problem with being an atheist and being a part of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, whatever you believe God might be, that's okay with us. So it's your God.
God meets you where you are.
Says,
love meets you. Right.
That's right. So so it's really a really open process to recover under, because, you know, it includes everyone. And
what,
all the people that are... Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
No, what were you saying? Nope, go ahead. Mm-hmm.
All the people that are in AA, you know, are willing to help everybody else, especially the newcomer, the new person that comes in.
Yeah.
So you have an instant group of, you know, people that are willing to help you, and hundreds of meetings around you all the time. So it's not like an availability problem, although before I went to my first few meetings, I didn't know there was any meetings. Because they're done quietly, and you don't know what's going on.
Wow.
But there were thousands of meetings every week in Los Angeles, 3,000, I think.
Right. And you said on here, the program, I'm sorry, Miss Annie, what were you about to say? Uh-huh.
No, I just said, well, that there were that many meetings in Los Angeles, that's all. I would like to say about 12-step. The reason I stayed with it for like 12 or 15 years, I'm not sure how long, was the camaraderie, because other people in the meeting would share and I would learn their stories and realize I wasn't alone, you know?
Right.
So even if, you know, the 12 steps weren't the perfect thing for me, the meetings were.
Yeah.
That's right.
And that's what I
the group
I'm glad,
is called a fellowship. Fellowship,
yeah.
Because you know everybody is like on the same page. Everybody, we're all even, and we're all willing to help each other. Especially you know, people who have a little time, they turn around and they offer their hand to the person.
Your phone's breaking up.
And this is constantly going on. I'm sorry.
That's okay. And something, your phone was breaking up. Something that you said in here says the program not only helped him get clean and sober, but also gave him a place to give up his secrets and tools by which he's recovered. And so that's exactly what you guys are talking about, that camaraderie, that unity, that support. And honestly, I'd rather be around people who are loving, supportive, understanding, encouraging me for my healing, for my change, instead of making me feel bad and talking about me and judging me and laughing at me and setting me up and being mean. You know, I'd rather be around people that are broken and working on their healing and showing me God's love, which is really love. I'd rather be around that, to be quite honest with you. I don't care about the titles. I don't care about the any of that stuff. I'd rather.
See, there aren't any titles and there aren't any bosses, you know. And all the service organizations are temporary. And when your term is up, you're replaced by somebody else that gets voted in by the group. So you know, there's no boss at all. There's a few pieces of literature that we all agree that we'll follow. But you can follow anything you want too, in addition to that. And you know, this is where I gave up my secrets for the first time. Because I was
without judgment.
I was encouraged to. Yeah.
Right. Without judgment.
And so I would share that one of the reasons that I drank so heavily was because I was abused as a child when I was, you know, in third grade or whatever it was, fifth grade. And people would listen to that. And I would not normally share that with anybody, but AA people, they understand the spiritual principle of keeping somebody's secrets private and anonymous. Yeah.
And self-medicating, like, we can relate. I mean, I've been there. I understand. I dealt with addiction, And, you know, I'm always very supportive of people that are working on their recovery, trying to be better. Every day is a new day, and we encourage people. We say, hey, we don't want people to take their lives. We don't want people to take their lives. And in order for people to feel like they're empowered to move forward from their mistakes or from their pain or from their abuse and their addiction or whatever they're dealing with, we have to support their change and not keep holding them hostage to the past. And so at the end of the day, love conquers all. And so it's so important that we all operate in a spirit of love and encouragement for one another and respect where we all are. We did not grow up the same. We don't, you know, believe in the same things. But one thing that we have in common is we're survivors of abuse. And that's one thing that I love about NASCA, that there are so many different nationalities, so many different ethnicities, so many different backgrounds, and we're able to come together and we're able to support each other and encourage each other to walk in our change. I love that. And even you, Bill, you know, being transparent. Go ahead. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
No, just thank you for being transparent.
Yeah. I'm sorry. I'm stepping on you. Go ahead.
No, it's the same thing. No, I was just saying that I appreciate even your own transparency. You could be on a high horse, you know, but you're even, you know, being transparent and letting people know that you yourself have been through this and you can understand and you're just being human and you're coming and you're just sharing your story. And we just all appreciate you for doing that. It takes such bravery. And such high level of healing to do that, seriously.
That's very kind. You know, NASCA is the way it is, not because of the 12 steps, but because of the 12 traditions. Not that I want to get people confused, but there's also the 12 traditions. And we follow the 12 traditions.
You got 3 minutes. What are they?
I know.
You
I'm
got
watching
3 minutes.
The clock. I know.
Me too.
That's why I don't want to get it down too far down the road here. But if you are interested in the 12 traditions, you go to the NASCA's front page of the website, and you go to the last red menu that pops down, the blue menu pops down under the red, and it talks about the 12 traditions. It's the second to last link there, and it lists what the 12 traditions are. These we do follow because they are the spiritual principles for the group. Nope, these are not guides for a person. It's for the group. And I strongly believe in the 12 traditions as probably the best philosophical tradition of, they call it tradition.
What are they? What are
for
they?
A group. Well, you can click on the, I don't want to take all the time by answering that, but the next show I could.
Okay.
Our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity, NASCA unity. Mm. For our group purpose, there's but one ultimate authority, a loving God, as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are the trusted servants. They do not govern. The only requirement for NASCA membership is a desire to recover and heal from child abuse and trauma. Four, each group should be autonomous except in matters affecting other groups or NASCA as a whole. Five, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the adult survivor of child abuse who still suffers. Six, NASCA groups ought never endorse, finance, or lend the NASCA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. Seven, every NASCA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. Eight, the National Association of Adult Survivors of Child Abuse should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. Nine, NASCA as such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10. The National Association of Adult Survivors of Child Abuse has no opinion on outside issues, hence the NASCA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11. Our public policy relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. And 12. Anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to put principles before personalities.
Wow, such an expert, such a professional. That is Bill, the president of NASCA Stop Child Abuse Now. Thank you guys for joining us tonight. Miss Annie and myself will definitely have to have you back. Thank you for joining us. God bless. And remember, if you see Sir Bill, we're going to have you come back. Right, Miss Annie?
Yep.
Sure. We're going to have him come back. This was a great show. And again, we love you. And thank you for your transparency. And thank you for all that you do for our community. Everybody, have a blessed night.
Thank you, ladies. Thank you for a good show.
Good night.
Appreciate it. Night now. Good night.